Welcome to the Cordwainers In Your Shoes podcast. My name is Katie Greenier and I'm the Creative Talent and Network Director at Pentland Brands. Cordwainers are shoemakers and today the worshipful company of Cordwainers works to promote footwear design and entrepreneurship in both education and the fashion industry. To celebrate the company's 750th anniversary, we have recorded this series to explore what it is like to live in the shoes of those who make them. So today I am joined by Ian Watson, CEO and driving force behind one of Britain's most successful shoe brands. As the UK's largest specialist footwear brand, Hotter Shoes sells over 1 million pairs of shoes a year to more than 4 million customers around the world. Ian is credited with having accelerated the company's digital growth, and Hotter Shoes is now seen as a major player in the e-commerce space. By repositioning Hotter Shoes as a digitally led direct-to-consumer e-commerce platform, Ian has successfully navigated both the COVID-19 pandemic and the downturn in traditional bricks-and-mortar retail environments, helping us to ensure the brand's longevity, growth and investment opportunities. So today, this is very unusual for me because I have an audience. Normally, it's my podcast victim and my lovely sound engineer, Alex. And today there is a full audience and our Zoom visitors. So welcome, everyone. And it's lovely to have you all here with us. So, Ian, going to start off. Where did you grow up?
Wow.
That's a good starter, isn't it?
Let's get straight in. Where did I grow up? So I was born in a town called Buxton in Derbyshire. And then as a family, we moved to very close to South Manchester, Stockport area. My dad worked at Manchester Airport, so we lived there. And then when I was about 7 or 8, I moved to a place called Chapel Enley Frith, which none of you will have heard of, but that's... quite close to Buxton as well, about 7 miles down the road, and it's where my dad's family were all came from. So I went to secondary school in Chapel Enley Frith. And if you ever live in Chapel Enley Frith, I wouldn't suggest you do it, particularly in the e-commerce world, because now they would say, can you spell that for me? Chapel-en-le-frith. I've done that a few times, so that's where I grew up.
And so your dad worked at the airport.
He did, yeah.
And what did your mum do?
My mum was a housewife, so she looked after me and my sister. My dad worked probably 7 days a week. He was a land surveyor, so he designed Terminal 2 and 3 in the second runway at Manchester Airport.
Wow.
So, yeah, he was pretty clever, my dad.
And so what was school like for you?
It's another tough question. How do you answer that? I guess I was neither in the cool gang nor in the SWAT gang, so I was somewhere in the middle.
Nice.
So I was clever but didn't want to appear to be. And I really didn't like homework, so I was probably a bit of an underperformer at school, I would suggest.
And how did your parents feel about that?
They were not happy. my dad wanted us all to be the best that we could be, and I think, you know, as a parent now, that's what everybody wants you to do. But he was pretty strict, my dad, so he checked my homework and things like that, which I didn't particularly appreciate. So, we battled a little bit in my teenage years, and my mum was very maternal, telling him off all the time, so I managed to play my mum quite strongly so she'd step in so I didn't get into that much trouble. I spent most of my time with part-time jobs, and from being 12, 13 years onwards, I was more interested in how I could make some money through a number of part-time jobs I had.
So what part-time jobs did you have?
I had quite a varied range of part-time jobs, and you'll laugh when I tell you the one I was the best at. So I obviously had a paper round. Well, not obviously, I don't think people have paper rounds anymore, do they? But I did. And I also worked on a market stall selling women's clothes. And I was really good at it, right? I was really good at it. And if I say so myself. And then that led me, and I did that for years, from being about 12.
Why were you so good at it?
I was just... Well, we had an eye for detail. We had some pretty upmarket. They weren't particularly upmarket at all, but they were slightly better market clothes than some of our competitor set. Listen to me now, right?
I know.
On my word. Like we segmented the market when I was 12. I don't know. I just like talking to the customers. So, yeah, it was fun.
Did you go to uni or did you study further?
Yeah, so I basically, so I left school when I was 16. So I dropped out my A-levels. I felt that I was way too clever to study. I then went and told my dad this story over the dinner table, and he didn't speak to me for at least 6 weeks. You know, if I was eating at the table, he'd get up, go somewhere else, which is quite unusual in our house because, you know, everybody ate at the table. So he was breaking the rules, basically. So that was a bit of a problem. So then I got a job as an office junior in a chemical business. And I've been very fortunate throughout my whole career to have some really good mentors. I got there and I remember on my first day that they said to me, right, okay, we're going to do yellow copy invoice filing. Now, again, for the audience, probably no idea what I'm talking about. So it was a copy of the invoice that had gone to a customer. And these were then held both alphabetically and numerically. And for the first 4 days, all I did was file yellow pieces of paper. And I thought, nah, this is not what I've got in mind. I thought you were going to put me in charge of the sales team. And there was a managing director and the office manager and the finance director. I got on all very well with them. And then one day, the old chairman who'd been off sick because he'd had a heart attack came back to work. And I was messing about at the back of the office, spinning around in my chair. And I was ordered into his office. And he said to me, what's your name? And I told him. And he said, why are you not at school? I said, oh, I'm too clever to go to school. I'm going to build this business with you. And within the day, I was enrolled on a ONC or a BTEC National Certificate in Business and Finance. And then I did that. And then I did my HNC in the same. And then I did my degree. And then I did my postgraduate in marketing all at the same company.
And that was all for 10 years,
part-time study.
Amazing.
So the lesson, the moral of the story is study while you're at school and at university, because it takes a lot longer if you do it part time.
So they must have really enjoyed your punchiness and your sort of.
I think they tolerated me. I think
but to put you through all that education, they must have thought, oh my. So was that at Shipyard?
Yeah. So I did every job in that company. I did every single job from I finally got off the yellow pieces of paper, thank God. But then I worked in the sales office. I worked in accounts for 2 years, accounts receivable, accounts payable. Then basically every time I changed something in my university course, the MD said, what are you studying? Until finally I said, hey, I'm majoring in marketing. My dissertation's in marketing. He said, hey, we've never had a marketing function here. Would you like to build it from scratch? And I said, yeah, great. So I did that. I did that for 10 years. And I stayed with the company for 10 years.
So then you went to Irwin Industrial Tools, based in Germany.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
So I went to work for a company called, it was called American Tool Company at the time. And we had a factory called Record. For any of you who did woodwork at school, those big blue vices were all Record vices. And the chisels you used were Marples chisels. And we owned those brands. So I went to work there as senior product manager and worked my way up to marketing director. And then the company was bought by an American conglomerate called Newell Brands, as it's known today. And the CEO had built the DeWalt brand, which is big power tool brand, from scratch to be $7 billion at the time. And he became the CEO. And when they bought the company, they did a talent review and they force ranked everybody in the company. And they basically fired my boss and my boss's boss and said, it's quite an interesting day. And I remember it very well. And they basically said, look, you've got the opportunity to move to Munich and set up a design center for our tool business. And we want you to be vice president of marketing. But wow. I thought, I've never been to Germany and I can't speak German. And my boss, who's very forthright, and he still is one of my best friends today, said, well, learn. Right? And I said, what if I can't do it? And he said, we'll fire you. There's only two ways in life, up or out. Which way do you want to go? So I went home and said, oh, by the way, I'm moving to Germany. And off I went.
So where did you live?
I lived in Sheffield. So the Record factory was in Sheffield, in a place called Darnell in Sheffield, close to Meadowhall. And off I went to Germany, and you know, I stayed there I was with the company best part of 8 years, and was responsible for everything outside of North America.
And did you learn to speak German?
I did, and my wife is German, so that was probably a good reason to learn.
There's the best reason to learn.
Yeah.
So what do you think these businesses taught you?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think if you want something, you've got to go and try and get it, right? And you shouldn't be put off by the fact that you're probably going to fail, right? It's when you trip over, it's just making sure that you're learning from those mistakes and trying not to make it again and try to do it when nobody's looking. But I think, you know, my time at in the chemical business, I learned everything about that business. I would say it was better than an MBA because I know every job backwards. I know how to do it because I've done it. I think my time at Newell was pretty high pressure, high politics, and learning how to manage in a three-way matrix and how to deal with Americans. You know, my job was trying to get, you know, you can't get any further diverse cultures than Americans and Germans. You just can't. And I think most of my job was trying to explain. Right. You know, so when the Americans were on the phone going, yeah, man, we're going to do this. We're going to get it done today. Blah, 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 blah. And the Germans were, you know, like, what are they saying? They've not even started. I said, no, what they mean is they're going to start and think about it today. Yeah, but that's not what they said. I said, I know what they said, but that's not what they meant. Really? Why don't they say these Americans, you know, and there's words I can't say today. But so I kind of split that role. And then from that, I guess I then went to work for a business called Britax, which makes car seats for kids, which was my first move into private equity, which again was different. You know, I went to work for my old boss at Newell, and I was going to go and work in the US with Newell. And he said, I've got a better idea. I'd like you to come to Carlisle Private Equity. You've got an interview tomorrow. We've got this car seat business and this child business that we need to turn around, and you need to invest. And naively, I didn't do that much due diligence. I just trusted him and I liked the people at Carlisle. I said, yeah, let's give it a whirl. So, and then off I went into the world of private equity.
So how did that end up?
Yeah, pretty good actually. So we bought the, you know, so I worked for Carlisle. I think when I joined, they'd valued the business about £175 million on the balance sheet, and we sold it for £446 million 4 years later in 2011.
It's so not bad, is it?
That was all right. It was better than, yeah, it's the worst things that could have happened. So we parted like it was 1999 for a couple of days, and then we realized that we had to stay with the business and keep going. So yeah, then we moved to another private equity house and I stayed there for another 4 years, based in Germany.
So what led you to the footwear industry?
Yeah, well, and well, you know, Master. I like it. You call Peter Master, by the way. I think it's pretty cool, right? No, I've never done it before, but I like it when I come in the room and everyone's referring to you as Master. Peter, it's pretty cool, isn't it? So my step into the footwear industry was working for Peter at Startright. So, you know, and to put it into perspective, I'd only worked in big businesses, or much bigger businesses, predominantly in private equity or in a blue chip environment. So to move into a family business was different for me. I told it to my wife that, you know, I was working crazy hours at Britax, and I said, look, we've never lived in England, right? It's actually okay, right? So I told her, right, this is pretty, it's okay, right? And I said, let's go to Norfolk. I said, I've never been to Norfolk myself, but I'd say, and that's not true, actually. I went to Caister-on-Sea as a child. And if anybody's from, knows Caister-on-Sea, right? It's a bit like Barbados, but just a little bit cooler. And so I told my wife, so I took her to the Ship Inn in Caister-on-Sea, right? And for anybody who doesn't know it, it's not the nicest place. I said, let's go to Norfolk. I said, how hard can it be? And, you know, I'm going to work less and it's going to be nice. We'll go every week to the coast. So that's why I sold it to my wife. And we relocated from Germany to the UK. 2 weeks later, there was this thing called a referendum. And the Brits voted for Brexit. And we literally, I know, I think we'd only moved in the May, Peter, from memory, right? And this way, I think that was in the June. So yeah, so that was quite an interesting, move personally. But then, yeah, then I came to Startright and started to learn about the footwear business.
So you were the first CEO to be appointed outside the family at Startright. They must have had massive trust in you. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I think absolutely. And I think probably the massive trust is from Peter, to be perfectly honest. You know, Peter was the CEO and the chairman, and they took the decision to get an outside chairman, Stephen Riley, and myself as the CEO. So we went through a process I think I came to Norwich the first time, just met Peter and had a good look round, and then there was a couple more rounds after that, and then here I am in the footwear business.
So do you think footwear is in your blood now?
I'd be lying if I said I'm going to be in the footwear business forever. I think that would be a lie. I think products are in my blood. Every business I've been in, my new old Rubbermaid business, it was all about products and consumers. Britax is all about products and consumers. And you know, the footwear business ultimately starts and ends with the products. If the product's rubbish, your business is not going to perform. And I think even more so, actually, I think footwear is much more of a black art than other consumer businesses I've been in. Because in another consumer business, you know, so take car seats, for example, right? It's physics, okay? This is about acceleration, hitting an object, and how the seat performs in that crash scenario. And if you get the physics right and you win all of the test reports, everybody wants to buy the safest product for their child, right? So again, it starts with product performance. Same with a lot of the Newell brands, you know, my tool business, you know, our drill bits, we wanted to get more holes out of a cordless battery. Okay, so if you can drill 200 holes instead of 100, the consumer understands that, because when the top of a scaffold and the battery keeps bloody running out, right, they're a problem, right? So they notice it, they get it. Footwear is not that kind of business, is it? You can have the most logical thought process of why this product is going to win, and it doesn't. And people call that having an eye. And I'm such a logical person. I still struggle with this concept, right? Trust me, that's a winner, is not something that sits really easy with me, right? And therefore, show me the facts why it's a winner is a much better conversation to have with me.
So how do you deal with that when your consumer is a child?
Well, I think, again, I think depending on the user behavior and if the purchase criteria is driven by the child. So certainly as children get older, they become much more of the influencer, I think, at a younger age than they don't. It's the same in adult footwear, you know, where I am now, is even trickier because, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about what happens when you get older, which are just physically not true. You know, so it was interesting in the pandemic, you know, as the pandemic hit, everyone told me, well, none of our consumers are going to use the internet. Well, let me tell you, it's the highest growth area is in over 55s using the internet, because all of these consumers can use FaceTime to ring their grandchildren, and the lockdown has changed consumer behaviour. So I think footwear is an interesting category. I really do enjoy being in it, but products, most products kind of excite me.
So how did you go from Startright to Hotter? Tell us this story.
Yeah, so
do you know this?
Yeah, I got a call from out of the blue, to be dead honest. I got a call out of the blue from Egon Zehnder and said, we have a private equity opportunity for you again. Would you like to come and talk to us? I said, hey, I'm just on my way to London. They said, that's great, because we'd like to see you at 2:30. And it was like 12 o'clock. I was at Norwich train station. So it was a complete coincidence. And I went and met my now chairman. And I was there about 45 minutes. And they said, right, okay, would you like to come work with us? It was no more complicated than that. And again, I said, hey, I'm leaving. I'm going back to Germany for Christmas. So, and here I am. Here I am at Hotter.
How exciting is that? So tell us a little bit more about Hotter, the handwriting, the details, and what goes into making Hotter, the Hotter brand, the Hotter product.
Yeah, so again, I think it's quite widely published that Hotter was struggling when I joined. So I'd been held by two suites of private equity businesses. So the Holgrave family started the business in 1959, and very successful business based in the Northwest, and was sold to a business called Gresham's Private Equity, and then they subsequently sold it to Electra. And I think what had happened is the business had appointed a number of professional managers, and I think it had just lost its way in terms of what the brand was and what the product range should be. So what had happened over time is that because the marketing group had not been actively promoting some of the benefits of the comfort technology that was in the shoe, therefore the product people had started to strip some out of them and saying, well, if you're not going to talk about them, then we're not going to put those features into the products, and we're going to save a little bit of cost. And there, over time, you end up with a product range which is not differentiated and not clear on where the brand sits. So that was the first thing I really looked at, to be honest. I mean, on my background, product marketing. So now the product range is focused back in pure comfort. And we've started to include new technologies and materials back into that product. So we have a strategic agreement with BASF Chemicals, and we use their Infinergy product, which is the cornerstone of Adidas Boost. We have the exclusive license for use of that in brown shoes. We created a Cushion Plus range and a Stability Plus range so that we can start and create ranges for specific wants and needs of consumers, dependent on arch type and their foot shape and some requirements they have. And we're really trying to take this business back to being, in terms of handwriting, very classic. Okay, so we're not going to be at the edge of cool, but we're also, that doesn't mean to say that our products don't have to be stylish. So we're trying to develop classic products, but using much more modern technologies and materials to give all-day comfort.
It seems that your formula is to move brands away from bricks and mortar stores. Do you think this is the way forward for all brands?
I think the world's very fluid, right? So we've not moved away completely from bricks and mortar. We have 17 of our own stores, and we have seven concessions now in garden centres. So we have 24 outlets. So we've not moved away completely. What we did was take about 55 stores out during the pandemic. I think bricks and mortar is an essential part of the complete channel mix, is what I really think. I think what you're seeing currently is increased digital costs to get to consumers. Therefore, I think you'll see a little bit of a swing back to the high street, is what you see. I don't think you'll see a swing back to the steady state of the high street as it was. And even our own high street stores, we were in the process of including much more technology in there in terms of 3D foot scanning and some of the ability to order in store. We've taken a big chunk of our inventory out of those stores because consumers are very happy for the shoes to be delivered to them next day. So I think it's changing. I think you're seeing quite a lot of concessions in different stores that are here today, that B&Q have done a deal with Asda, as have New Look. So you're going to see that some of these big site stores are going to have multiple concessions within it. So I think it won't be the same as it is today, but I certainly think high street stores have got a place to play.
How else has the industry changed in your lifetime?
My lifetime? I'm not that old. Just for the tape and the podcast, I'm only 49, right? So they had shoes when I was a child, right?
But probably the changes have happened in the most 10 years.
Yeah,
really.
Well, so certainly coming up to 6 years in the industry, I guess the changes are around sustainability for sure. I think channels of distribution are changing massively. And I think that's an enormous change. And I think we're going to see a massive change in supply chains. I think that's what's coming next. Because the ability to be able to react quickly, I think the current issues that everybody's got on supply chain.
And do you think in terms of supply chain, that means moving back to the UK?
Well, we'd like to think so. We obviously, we half manufacture, right? Because we final assemble. So we buy uppers from around the world, and then we direct injection mold in Skelmersdale. So we think that's a competitive advantage in terms of the ability to be able to turn that into finished goods quickly. We can receive uppers on a Monday and have turned it into finished goods on a Tuesday. So we can react very, very quickly. And I also think there's a positive to the environment because we're only shipping half of the product around the world. So therefore, you know, it's predominantly half the carbon footprint, which we're working hard on. So I think will we end up with a cut and sew operation in the UK? Highly unlikely. I think, but certainly utilising Southern Europe or Eastern Europe may become much more advantageous than it is currently.
So sustainability is a frequently used word and perhaps overused.
Yeah.
What does it mean for Hotter?
So I think we're at the very start of this journey, to be honest. I think we're starting to really review what our carbon footprint is, and we're looking at different materials on how we can reduce that carbon footprint, both in terms of upper design, but also the sole unit designs, as well as how we're shipping these products around the world. I think we've been quite keen not to start a greenwashing process. So we're not actively we're not actively pushing some of our sustainable credentials until we've got it across a complete range, was the conscious decision we made to do it. But certainly in coming to the next season, we're going to push that much harder.
I think it's great that designers just actually have it in their brain when they start,
start
the brief in terms of what something should look like.
Yeah, I think so. Materials you can use as well. And, you know, I think the creativity around materials which are out there now and what you can use, I think is going to be important moving forward.
And probably a very important story for your business as well.
Absolutely.
What do you see are the greatest challenges for the footwear industry?
So I think this whole sustainability and supply chain is massive. And I think, you know, finding an answer to leather, if someone can crack that code, I think is going to be one of the biggest challenges to use much more recycled leather and still get the same properties as you get from a virgin leather, I think is still relatively difficult to do. And I think that's one challenge. I think the tanning process within leathers is, you know, again, is a problem, right? And when you start and look at chrome-free leathers and such things like that, again, there's a huge opportunity, but I think it still needs some further development. And then the second part of that is this whole supply chain challenge. You know, I think, and anybody who's in the footwear industry has probably aged quite heavily over the last couple of years, me definitely. But, you know, just as you think you're getting through some of these issues, then Chennai is under 2 meters of water, or you can't get any zips from YKK or from China or whatever. So I think it's going to focus people on making sure that they've got something that's probably cost a little bit more, but is a little bit closer to home so they don't have this risk.
But I think a part of that sustainability conversation, we're hoping that the audience and the consumer actually respects the level of quality and sustainability that has gone into a product, yeah, to make those small changes.
Yeah.
What's been your most challenging project, collaboration, life experience, whatever you want?
You've only got an hour, haven't
you?
I know. I think, hey, that probably the biggest challenges that you have is where you have multiple people involved in a project, right? So I think I've been involved in a lot of M&A work where I bought and sold companies. They're always quite tricky. And I also think, you know, collaborating with other brands is also quite tricky sometimes because everybody's got their own brand guidelines of what they're trying to achieve and work through. I think with all of these things is just staying pretty cool and patient throughout the process is what I'm trying to tell myself is the best way of dealing with them. Not always successfully. I could hear Peter laughing.
Would you see yourself as a cool-headed kind of reactor?
No, I'm working on it. I'm working on it. We're in the process of listing our company. So I think when I'm a PLC CEO, then I'll have to keep my thoughts a little bit closer to myself. But no, normally is what you see is what you get with me.
I think that's quite nice, though.
It works sometimes.
So should we do the quick fire?
Oh my God!
Questions.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is my favourite round.
This might do it. Can I say pass if I don't know the answer?
No,
no.
We've got no buzzers.
Right.
It's just the way it is.
Okay.
If you could talk to the Prime Minister, what would you say?
I'd say, have you really got a plan? That's what I'd say.
What fashion trend do you just not get?
I'm not a big fan of neon. And someone told me on the train as well that it's quite cool to wear socks and sandals now, and I'm not getting that.
I saw someone wearing Crocs and socks.
Yeah, but I wouldn't be a fan of that either. I'm not a big fan of sheepskin boots as well. You know, when you see people walking down the street and they look like the heels are collapsed.
Yeah, looks lazy.
I don't get that. I don't get that.
Are you a morning or night person?
Definitely morning.
Marmite? Love it? Hate it?
I just don't like the smell of it. I've never tried it, so hate it. And I'm dead fussy. Just
never
the smell,
tried...
No, I'm really fussy.
And has your German wife tried Marmite?
That's a really good question. I think she has, yeah. I couldn't tell you if she likes it or not, though.
Okay.
The smell's just, I'm not hanging around when I smell it.
If you were stranded on a tropical island, what two things would you want with you?
That's really easy. Sunscreen, because I burn to a crisp, and I'd want my sunglasses. Because you don't need anything else, do you? No point taking one book as a writing standard.
What was the last thing you fixed?
Probably nothing.
Okay.
I'm no.
You're not a fixer?
No. Not anything handy around the house. Okay. One of the inside, we've got one of these corner cupboards in the kitchen, you know, where you open it up and the thing all spins out and blah, 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 blah. It's in about 100 pieces for a week. I've had to call a man to do it because I have no patience for things like that.
No DIY in your house?
No. And I used to run a tool company. I've got more tools. I've got more tools in my garage. My dad always used to laugh about it, saying, how can you have this many tools and not even know what they're called? I said, I know what they're called. I know what they're called, but I just don't know how to use them.
Tea or coffee?
I can do both. I'm on tea at the minute, but I can do coffee as well.
Could you survive in the wilderness?
Definitely not. Definitely not. Hated the cubs. I had to go to the cubs because my dad was a venture scout. It was horrible.
What song do you know off by heart?
I know Ella Fitzgerald, Blue Moon, off the top of my head.
Fancy giving us a bit of a...
No.
You were going to say that. What looks delicious but tastes terrible?
Yeah, you see, and this is where I've got a problem because, you know, I'm so fussy. If I don't like the look of it, I won't even try it.
So
I even used to pretend that I was allergic to things. I used to tell people I'm allergic to that. I can't try it.
How do you cope when you're travelling abroad?
Oh, terrible. Terrible. I like Indian food, so India's okay for me, but China is a little bit iffy. But I think I've got better the older I've got. And, you know, it comes to a point where if you're on a two-week trip and you've not eaten for 3 days, you've got to give it a whirl, haven't you? Well, lots of cereal bars is another top tip that I normally roll with.
Would you rather be too hot or too cold?
Definitely too cold.
I need to ask another question now because you spoke a lot about your dad. And I know the quickfire round's finished, but it's just after the comment you made about him not speaking to you when you didn't go to uni. Yeah. What does he think now?
Well, unfortunately, he's passed away. But he, it was quite funny. As I got older and I got a little bit of success behind me, he used to tell me I was working too hard.
Did he?
So he went full circle, to be perfectly honest. You don't spend enough time with your family. You're always working you. And I'm like, Dad, come on. You can't have it both ways.
I'm sure he would be so proud.
So he's... He was very proud. So, he was good. It all turned out well in the end. And actually, when my... My mum passed away when she was quite young, so me and my dad became quite close, or very close. So, it was a very different relationship when I got in my 20s, 30s and 40s.
What's so lovely is to hear that someone that didn't go to university but still succeeded because they had the passion and drive and just the work ethic of an ox to survive and just get out there. And I think so many people probably are so put off by that and think that university is the only route. Mm-hmm. And what is so lovely is to hear that actually you just didn't want to go to university and you wanted to make it.
And again, anyone can go any route, can't they? You know, as I sit back now and go, God, I wish I'd gone to university. When, you know, my kids, I'm pushing them quite as hard as my dad. Not quite as hard, but I am actually. You know, I think, wow, good for you. You know, you're having that experience. Again, it's whatever's right for you, isn't it? And, you know, I ended up going to university, but it was painful because I did it part-time, so I was working. But actually, it was probably best for me because I quite like having a couple of quid in my pocket and out and about with my mates.
So it's been absolute pleasure talking to you. And now I'm going to take some questions from the audience, which probably be more scary than
I'm not so sure.
So first question, as the ex-CEO of Startright, do you see an opportunity for Hotter to break into kids market that is continuing to grow over adults? Sorry, Peter, not my questions.
Well, obviously not. So, you know, we're in the middle of selling our company, or now we're going to float it. So we did look at kids, to be perfectly honest. And but the challenge is that it will be far easier for us to expand into other categories other than kids. So, you know, we've got a database of 4.6 million people over 55, which is 29% of the female audience. And yet only 10% of our turnover comes from men's. So we probably most definitely do men's before we do kids, because again, it's a different audience who you're trying to attract. And Peter and I were just talking about it. The beauty of of the hotter businesses. The average age of digital recruits that are coming into the brand is 53. So if I can keep those people 53, 63, 73 through their life, you know, the value of that, lifetime value of that customer over a period is much greater than if we did kids and, you know, you've got them for a short period. So we've got no plans for kids.
So no plans for ever ask that. How has COVID impacted your business outside of shutting stores?
I think what it has done is just speed everything up. So we had a plan to digitalize the company, right? And in this life, I am a true believer, you can be the best CEO in the world, but if you haven't got luck and timing, you're not going to win, right? Yeah. And we were so fortunate that our new website platform was always planned to launch in June of last year. So, you know, COVID hit and we were ready to go. We'd already invested in our 3D foot scanning technology as well that we have in our stores. We'd already invested in the virtual reality we have in our app that allows you to put the physical shoe on your foot through virtual reality. So all of these things we queued up ready to go and then COVID hit. So I'm just very lucky, I think. So those were the big things that we did in the business. And what we also did was we tried to look after our people. So, you know, our factory, we closed the factory for the first lockdown, but the distribution center never closed. And actually, a lot of our success is down to the guys and girls in that distribution center who came in every day and put their masks on and kept packing shoes. And without them, we'd be in a very different place. So I think those would be the key things we did.
So the next question is, do you think being solely direct molded affects your ability to diversify your ranges and gain a new consumer?
That is a great question. And the answer is yes. Right. So if you look at some of the designs, because of the technical parameters of direct molding, therefore you end up sometimes with silhouettes that maybe are not as classic or as feminine as they could be. So that's definitely something we're looking at, right? So we do sell products outside of direct molding. About 15% of our turnover comes from them, particularly in sandals. But definitely there's an opportunity for us to expand this comfort offer. No, but we're not going to do that with any Me Too product designs, because earlier I talked about the technology transfer. So we need to make sure that anything that's not direct molded still has some unique properties for the comfort of the product. But it's a great question.
Well done, whoever asked
that
one.
Yeah, come work in my product team, because that's a really good one. It's the one I keep asking them.
So the perception of the brand is a mature nature. Are you looking to change this?
So it depends what your definition of mature is. So we have been making our product range slightly younger and our target audience is slightly younger. So when I joined, our average age of our consumer was in the 70s. Our average now is 63 and our digital recruits is coming in around 53. So I think over time we will bring this age down in terms of our user group, but equally with the product portfolio as well. So we're selling far more athleisure than we ever used to, as is the whole market. There's nothing new there. But certainly our deck shoe range and certainly our boots and winter and sandals in the summer are becoming slightly younger. So this is about evolution, not revolution. We don't want to turn off our lady who's 73, who's been a very loyal customer to us, and they continue to be really strong customers for us. But over time, we do need to bring that age group down. We start to see it in some of our marketing communications as well. So historically, comfort's an interesting word, isn't it, right? So comfort can also have negative connotations. You're comfortable can also mean you've kind of given up. You know, I couldn't be bothered today because I'm dead comfortable, right? And therefore, we're trying to change this definition of comforts as something that's engaging. So, you know, when you are truly comfortable within yourself, you can do anything you want to do. And therefore, it's subtle, but there's such a difference. So we're trying to make an empowering version of comfort is what we're trying to do with the business and the brand.
So what does a normal day in your life look like?
I laughed when I saw that question because I don't know what normal... I don't think I've ever been normal. I don't know what normal is. I don't know what normal people do. You know, normal people get up in the morning, go to work, come home again, right? I don't do that. I don't think I've ever, apart from my 3 years at Star, I don't think I've ever got up in the morning, left my house, gone to an office, gone home to my house. I've never done that in my whole career. So normal, let's do, should we do normal today then? So normal today is that I had a couple of calls this morning on trading because Cyber Monday, right? Big e-commerce business. Went through all the trading pack. I then jumped on a couple of other calls, then jumped on the train and I came down here, had a meeting here, came along here. Now I'm going to catch the train to Wigan Northwestern, Skelmersdale. I get in about 10 o'clock tonight and I've got a 7 o'clock conference call tomorrow morning. So that's kind of normal for me.
So what do you do when you're not working?
I don't know.
Do you have any hobbies or side hustles?
No, I don't have any friends, I don't have any hobbies. I just nothing. I've got 5 kids. There's no hobbies.
You have a hobby then.
I've got a hobby. Yeah. I didn't know how it worked till number 5 came along. Someone told me. So hey, weekends, particularly at the moment, is a little bit crazy. So I tend to come home on a Thursday or a Friday and then, hang out with the kids. I am a season ticket holder at Manchester City my whole life, obviously. And that is the beauty of working in Skelmersdale, is that every midweek game I do manage to sneak out. So the team at Skelmersdale probably know more about Manchester City's fixture list than they do the operating calendar, because they'll know if City are playing. I probably won't be there that night until late.
So. Entwined into the schedule.
Yeah, exactly.
So what have you done that you're most proud of?
I don't know. I think the older you get, the more reflective you become. So I think when I was younger, I was much more focused on being really successful and winning at all costs, right? And I think I've done some pretty cool things. You know, at Newell, we built the Irwin tool brand from nothing, right? And they sold it to Stanley Black & Decker for over $1 billion. So I'm pretty proud of that. That was cool. And I led that process in Europe. So that was great. Same with Britax. We did some pretty great stuff there. I think we accelerated a lot of the digital stuff at Startright. And at Hotter, we're doing all right. But ultimately, none of that really matters. You know, at the end of the day, I learned a little bit recently where I've had a couple of people who have worked with in other organisations who have become ill and had to step down or go and do something else. And, you know, they're yesterday's man 24 hours later, because the world keeps spinning. So I think, you know, I'm proud of what I've achieved today. But actually, it's not the be all and end all, is it? I would rather be known as somebody who helped people out a little bit along the way and wasn't a bad parent either than I don't know, winning employee of the year. Won a few of them, but you can't do anything with them, really.
So what would you do if you weren't CEO at Hotters?
I'd like Mr. Serrano's job. He's the chief executive of Manchester City. I quite like that. I'd love to understand how balance sheets in football work. And then I think I'm becoming an accountant, but I'd really love to know how those things work. I think I'm also waiting for Armani to call me, because I quite like that job. You know, I'd really quite like a fashion job. But look at me. I don't think that phone's ringing anytime.
You never know.
I don't think anyone's calling me anytime soon with a big fashion job. But no, I think, again, with any job, I think as long as you're happy and know what you're doing, you've got a pretty clear vision of what you're doing and you can have a bit of fun, I think that's all right.
So in the audience, we have students, footwear students.
Yeah.
What would be your biggest bit of advice to them?
I think the key thing I noticed with some of the designers that we work with sometimes is we don't necessarily start with the consumer, right? So again, it's very different because it's a different industry, but I was classically trained marketeer, right, in consumer goods, right? And you start with the consumer and you end with the consumer. And you start with the question, what is the problem I'm trying to solve? And I think that's very different in footwear. But I keep trying to get my team to go back and say, that all looks very great, but who is the consumer? What do they look like? And what is the problem you're trying to solve? And then I say, how much are we selling this product for in the market? And then they all look at me like, no, I'm the designer. I say, well, hang on a minute. We've got to design this to cost. Right, you're not going to come up with something and say, oh, it costs 18 quid to manufacture, therefore we're going to retail it for this. We start with what we're going to retail it for and work the way back. And I think there's I'm not quite sure of the correct phrase, but it's something like, you know, the best thing you can do in a creative brief is give someone a tight brief that maximizes the creativity. And I think that's That's where I'd start.
Have we got any questions in the room?
I've got one.
Go on then, Sarah.
So I think, personally, that people have a massive connection with their feet and footwear. And most people you speak to are really emotive about footwear. So my question is, why do you think that is? Being in lots of different product circles, and also my second part of that question, Ian, is, are you emotive about your footwear? And what brands do you buy?
Hey, that's a good question, because I'm getting... let me do the first question and then I'll tell you all about it, because I'm spending way too much money on shoes currently. Right, so... and I haven't got a single pair of hotter shoes. Just for everyone asks me that question, and I tell them I am not the target age group, just so we're clear. I'm getting there, but I'm not there yet, right? So I think that the first bit is, yeah, I think your body changes as you get older. So therefore, your feet get slightly wider once you get into your 50s. I think the first problems that everybody thinks they're going to live forever, don't they? Until they get, you know, you think you're, well, I do. I honestly, I'm going to live forever, right? And but the first time you have a bit of a problem and that kind of knocks you and you think, shit, maybe not, right? And I'm running quite a bit. And I've never particularly been injured. And someone told me they got a problem with the knee. Since they told me that, right, I'm like, oh, there's something wrong with my knee. I need to go out and check it out, right? And then suddenly, then I'm in runner's world saying, I think the way my feet are landing is causing me a problem with the knees. Next thing, I'm walking out with a 250 quid pair of trainers where my 50 quid ones will just not do anymore because I'm an overpronator. And I reckon I can do the park run 5 seconds faster with these trainers if they're 250 quid. So I think people get, as they become more au fait with health issues and whatever, I think then feet become, and therefore once you start and get into that circle, then I've got you, because you know, we can personalise products for you. So I think it's a great idea that people get preoccupied with their feet, right? And if anybody is, hotter.com is the place for you. Now, in terms of shoes, I have most definitely become much more of a shoe snob recently, right?
Good to hear.
And there is a shop in Norwich, which I am desperately trying to remember the name of. Brown Hills, and I'm looking at Peter because he'll know. They make they still make products in Norwich. Bow Hill and Elliot, right? So I discovered this shop, right, as I was trying to go. It's next to the Co-op Building Society, right? And I don't even know why I got an account for the kids at the Co-op Building Society, but anyway, they had one. And it was closed. And I was looking in the shoe shop. And I thought, this is a proper shoe shop. And now I'm hooked on this shop. Right. So there's a brand whose name escapes me. And you guys, Crockett and Jones. So I'm having a bit of a thing on Crockett and Jones currently. I've just bought... Hey, this is a shoe business, right? It's a shoe podcast. I can talk about shoes for a second.
You can talk about shoes.
I've never been able to find... I wanted some boots that I could wear with my suit. And I wanted some that were quite a thin profile, but I didn't want leather soles because I'm always walking around the streets of London and I don't want wet feet permanently. It drives me crazy, right? And I also don't want to slip because that's not cool, is it? Slipping on your face and saying... And I've normally got a suitcase and a backpack and God knows what. So I've just bought some, which they have a rubber sole, but a very thin one. And then... it's a suede, but it's proper black. So it's not like a split skin. Because suede, black suedes are quite tricky, aren't they? And at my price points, when we're making black suedes, they're obviously a slightly different material. So I bought those and they're jet black. And someone stood on my foot on the tube. Oh, man. Man, so now we'll walk around with a suede brush and it looks ridiculous. So today I was going to wear those, but I thought I haven't got space in my case to carry. But that's a great shop in Norwich and it's one of those classic shoe shops. So I've been buying and I bought a couple of other bits and bobs from there as well. I bought these boots from there, which is a German brand. But yeah, so I quite like shoes. I've got some Barkers, I've got a couple of Lokes. Oh, I bought some Grenson white trainers because they're pure white. Because again, you know, I don't want a logo on it. I don't want any greens or yellows. I want pure, if I want a pair of white trainers, I want white, right?
Sounds like we've got you hooked there, right?
No, yeah. I'm pretty obsessed with it. And I snapped one of the laces. And then I had to go and I went down to the factory because I thought, I'm not going buying shoelaces, right? could I find the right thickness white shoelace? No. So when I get in with the product team a little bit now, they wish I hadn't gone in because, you know, I'm now up to speed with the conversation around tans.
Right. Okay. So you.
Right, because that's another big shoe gig, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tans, the right tan. The right tan. That's not the right tan. What do you mean it's not the right tan? Explain it to me. It's just not the right tan. You've got to have an eye for this, Ian. Okay. So that's kind of fun. But yeah, I like shoes.
Thank you. Like
shoes. Any other questions from the audience?
You've answered the question I was going to ask you earlier because I saw that your ladies' range is four times as wide as the men's range.
Yeah.
But actually, if you're only selling 10% men,
yeah,
it's slightly overrepresented.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So, are you talking to your development team to try and address that?
Yeah, we're going to grow men's for definite. So I think it's a very different proposition for men than it is women, though. So I think the difference in women, particularly women who are in the 50s, is that they've probably gone through the stage of high heels. They've probably got a couple of issues that they've developed with their feet. So therefore, they understand comfort footwear far more than a man. You know, when we talk in focus groups to men and say this is comfort footwear, they go, well, aren't all shoes comfortable, right? The ones I've got on are comfortable. So therefore, it is a very different dynamic. But we think that the technology we're building into the products actually ticks a box with men. They get it. You know, they want straight out of the box comfort. They understand that much more than comfort. So we're just looking at that. And again, you know, there are some classic silhouettes that we don't have. When I first joined, the company had just developed a range of slightly more formal products, but again, they weren't injection molded. They didn't have any of the features. Our consumers are a bit older. They're not necessarily wearing brogues to go to work. So again, I think we're going to expand that men's range for definite. Yeah, I think we've got some to go out.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here today. And it's been great to walk in your shoes. And thank you so much for coming and being with us today and holding this sort of podcast sort of in conversation with us, because it's been so interesting.
No, you're very welcome. I've enjoyed myself.
You've been an absolute joy. So thank
Great.
You so
hey,
much.
Hey, thanks, Katie. Thank you, everyone. Cheers.
For more interest in Cordwainers livery, please visit our website, cordwainers.org, or our Instagram, Worshipful Company of Cordwainers.